Kid Billy got picked on at school for things he couldn't change. He tried his best to play it cool, but in the seventh grade, you either fit right in or you don't fit. That's just the cold hard truth. I wish that I'd have been the friend that Billy never knew. I think it's time to come together, you and I can make a change. Maybe we can make a difference, make the world a better place. Look around and love somebody, we've been hateful long enough. Let the good Lord reunite us till this country that we love's undivided.
Welcome back.
Undivided indeed, and the song connotes a sort of divisiveness, a sort of balkanization that lurks beneath the surface and most of us don't realize. But again, something is happening, and back to Cooper's Behold a Pale Horse, Chapter 1, Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars, the public might instinctively feel that something is wrong. Public cannot comprehend this weapon and therefore cannot believe that they are being attacked and subdued by a weapon. The public might instinctively feel that something is wrong, but because of the technical nature of the silent weapon, they cannot express their feeling in a rational way or handle the problem with intelligence. Therefore, they do not know how to cry for help or and do not know how to associate with others to defend themselves against it. When a silent weapon is applied gradually, the public adjusts and adapts to its presence and learns to tolerate its encroachment on their lives until the pressure, psychological via economic, becomes too great and they crack up. Therefore, the silent weapon is a type of biological warfare. It attacks the vitality, options, and mobility of the individuals of a society by knowing, understanding, manipulating, and attacking their sources of natural and social energy and their physical, mental, and emotional strengths and weaknesses. So, Project for a New American Century is Rebuilding America's Defenses. Remember that document, September 2000, the year before September 11, 2001? The document that called for, you know, hinted at a new Pearl Harbor strategy of tension episode that would galvanize support. The process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor, which was what September 11, 2001 was and has to this day been referred to. But that document also contained a curious bit on page 60 of the document, I believe. Yeah, information systems will become an important focus of attack. Now think about this with the concept of the silent war, or excuse me, the silent weapon for quiet wars in mind. The silent weapon is a type of biological warfare. It attacks the vitality, options, and mobility of the individuals of a society by knowing, understanding, manipulating, and attacking their sources of natural and social energy and their physical, mental, and emotional strengths and weaknesses. So, with that in mind, from Rebuilding America's Defenses, September 2000, information systems will become an important focus of attack, particularly for U.S. enemies seeking to short-circuit sophisticated American forces and advanced forms of biological warfare. Maybe that doesn't mean exactly what we think it means. Advanced forms of biological warfare that can target specific genotypes may transform biological warfare from the realm of terror to a politically useful tool. So we're talking about excerpts from the first episode. Episode 1, The Environment, of Aaron and Melissa Dyke's True Stream Media series, Overlooked, Lost in the Shining Hotel, as it relates to what you might call the, you know, common American experience today. It's an echo. It's another chapter in the saga of eliminationism. And as I said to open the first hour, if we're paying attention, especially as we came through the COVID shenanigans, you can see now very clearly, laid bare out in plain sight, that we are all, the general populace, receiving the exploitive treatment. The black, Native American, Jewish, Palestinian, African, Indian woman, you know, LGBTQ, insert disenfranchised group here, treatment. We are all receiving it. And as I said in the first hour, this society murders innocent unborn children with taxpayer money while it fines people for seatbelt violations in the name of saving lives. Something is clearly amiss. So perhaps we should look closer and more scrutinously than the soundbites we are fed, the Bernaysian soundbites we are fed. So we'll get back to Aaron and Melissa Dyke's Overlooked, Lost in the Shining Hotel, Episode 1, The Environment, in a second. First, I mentioned the excerpts at the end of the first hour of today's broadcast from, one excerpt in particular of John Taylor Gatto's Underground History Lesson with Richard Grove, where John Taylor Gatto tells us the history of this. And again, you can see this in Raoul Peck's HBO docuseries, Exterminate All the Brutes, 600 years in the making, according to Eileen Jones, 500 years in the making, according to John Schwartz over at The Intercept, hundreds of years in the making in any case. So you have to step back and take a long view of history, not just a generation, not just 10, 20 years, not just a generation, not even a century, but a longer view. And when you do, a picture starts to emerge. You can see it clearly, as John Taylor Gatto told us. Can we play that, please?
Out of way. To initially convert to whatever religion had a church in the area, and then when they were the majority, they would vote the thing out of business, take the assets, and reopen as a Unitarian parish. The entire Massachusetts School Committee, no accident, every last member was a Unitarian, even though there were less than 1% of the Massachusetts population, because they understood leverage. What is the symbol of the Fabian socialists in Britain? It's the wolf in sheep's clothing. They have a big laugh at how easy it is, you know, to fool. The funny thing is that Kitty Muggeridge, Beatrice Webb, who is really Fabian socialism, when she carried her husband around, but Beatrice is the welfare state architect. She was the niece of Herbert Spencer, the most articulate intellectual racist in human history. Root hog or die. She sat with him on his deathbed for 6 weeks, and both of them agreed they were after the identical goals, but by different means. He said, exterminate the brutes, the famous line from Heart of Darkness. And she said, kill them with kindness. You know, I noticed you had Ayn Rand on your shelf. The idea of taking care of somebody else, apart from the innocent charitable thing, is that you ruin them by doing that. It doesn't take very long to ruin them. So Beatrice Webb, the Fabian, and the great conservative Herbert Spencer, same bloodline, same goals, different methodology.
There you go. I really don't think that we need to say more. You know, it's a horrifying, terrifying realization. But, you know, for us to come to grips with reality and where we are and what's happening, even though it's unfolding at glacial speed, I think is helpful nonetheless. So with that, can we jump back to True Stream Media's Overlooked Episode 1 and the next little excerpt from that, please?
Kubrick would challenge his viewers to look deeply in the mirror, to the literal edge of the frame, to find the deeper context lurking out of the corner of our eyes. Compartmentalization and willful ignorance come easy when discussing the past. Quinn Smith, Jr. The sarcastic claim has been made that almost every horror film in the late 1970s and 80s featured a plot involving a haunted Indian burial ground. There were quite a few. Kubrick's entire film, The Shining, is on just such a burial ground. As in, all of the main locations he has cobbled together for the setting of The Overlook are places where indigenous people were forcibly removed and supplanted.
Has Tony ever told you anything about this place? About the Overlook Hotel?
History is never a one-sided story. Most Americans, especially those born in the 20th century, weren't taught much indigenous history in school at all. And most of what has been taught is set only in the context of pioneers or settlers, which, if it doesn't cast natives as villains, casts them as obstacles to settlement. So many Americans literally don't see the Indian. Out of mind, out of sight. The opening drive of the film begins in Glacier National Park, home to the Blackfeet for some 10,000 years before Europeans ever showed up. Glacier was their most sacred space, which they called the backbone of the world. In January 1870, a camp of Blackfeet belonging to Chief Heavy Runner, suffering smallpox, were sleeping soundly one night. The men had gone out to hunt, and the majority of the camp were women, children, and elderly men. Chief Heavy Runner's tribe had been deemed friendly to the U.S. government and were promised protection, even issued a safe conduct document from the U.S. Indian Bureau. Major Eugene M. Baker of the U.S. 2nd Cavalry, on the orders of General Sheridan, set out to suppress a specific band of Blackfeet under Mountain Chief, but came upon this friendly band sleeping instead. Warned by his own scout, Joe Kipp, that this was the wrong band of people, Major Baker is quoted as having said, "That makes no difference. One band or another of them, they are all Blackfeet, and we will attack them." He then ordered one of his sergeants to hold the scout at gunpoint and shoot him if he attempted to warn the sleeping tribe. Kipp shouted anyway, rousing Chief Heavy Runner, who ran towards the soldiers waving his paper from the Indian Bureau promising safety. The chief was immediately shot and killed. Once the first shot was fired, soldiers began firing into the lodges of sleeping people, then charged the camp. They sliced open lodge coverings with butcher knives and shot the unarmed sleeping inhabitants inside. Others were murdered with axes, and still others who were wounded but had not died from the initial attack were burned to death when they set the entire camp on fire. 217 lives were barbarically ended that night, including 15 men, 90 women, and 50 children. Despite public outrage, once word got out, an official investigation was suppressed. Major Baker, by the way, was accused of being drunk on the morning of the massacre. In a separate incident a couple of years later, the major was actually arrested by his superior officer for drunkenness and downgraded in his military role.
By 1860.
So, if you're paying attention to the dehumanization and the eliminationist mindset that is being fomented and sown in our midst, I think it's not a stretch to say we can expect the same here in America. We got another clip. We'll probably have to pause as we head into the break, but this is a gruesome tale. It's our own history here in America, though, even recently, as recently as, 50 years ago. And, you could even argue much more recently than that. So, back to the excerpt. Next
1869,
clip,
the Union Pacific Railroad had divided the buffalo into northern and southern herds.
Do you know what happened to the American buffalo? It's considered one of the most infamous conservation horror stories in American history, period.
On the South Platte, hunters built fires to keep the buffalo from water at night and killed them as they came to slake their thirst by day. 1875 saw the end. In 1875, the great southern herd was gone. By 1882, the Northern Pacific Railroad was built, and 5,000 hunters and skinners were emptying the northern range.
Some 40 million buffalo were purposefully slaughtered by the U.S. Army and other hired hunters because
Colonel Dodge had said, "Every buffalo dead is an Indian gone." And buffalo extermination was the unwritten policy in the winning of the West.
Many indigenous people starved after their main food source was eradicated, including the Blackfeet, who suffered starvation winters. The worst claimed some 700 lives in the winter of 1883-84. By contrast, 42 people perished in the Donner Party, and that story is still taught in history class in middle schools around the country to this day. By 1895, starving and desperate to save their children, the Blackfeet offered to sell lands they didn't even personally believe any man could own to the U.S. government, lands that would eventually become Glacier National Park. When Chief Whitecalf bitterly accepted the agreement, he was quoted as saying, "Chief Mountain is my head. Now my head is cut off. The mountains have been my last refuge." The sale included an agreement that the Blackfeet could hunt, fish, gather, and carry out their traditional rituals on the lands. But these subsistence rights were extinguished after the lands were officially designated as a national park, and the agreement was, air quotes, reinterpreted by the government. Removed from their most sacred spot, the Blackfeet were given a reservation on the border of the park. In the years that followed, the Great Northern Railway, whose Western Star locomotives were also proudly referred to as Empire Builders, recalling the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Star of Empire, ran a rail line directly through the Blackfeet Reservation. The railway erected luxury lodges throughout Glacier, including the massive Mini Glacier Hotel, a place that would only be open from June to September each year, then closed for the winter for even longer than the Overlook did in The Shining. The railroad then billed the Montana Park as America's Alps or America's Switzerland, further psychologically blunting the edges of the Wild West to offer travelers European-style architecture and civilization.
"There's a modern hotel and everything looks very comfortable and is very comfortable."
Chalets and waitresses wearing dirndls who served guests dessert while the orchestra played a waltz or a foxtrot.
"The waitresses at Glacier Park Hotel dress in Swedish costumes."
The hotel was once again mostly furnished in a rustic wilderness style, with copious bear skins draped over everything and buffalo skulls hanging up everywhere. Although also overlaid with Japanese lanterns for some reason. These lodges provided luxuries at the edge of nowhere, such as a barber shop, tailor shop, hospital, hot and cold running water, and telephones. In the 1970 Glacier National Park Historic Resource Study, James Shearer wrote, "The Great Northern Hotels were not simply rows of rooms where the tired traveler spent the night and hurried on the next morning. They were theaters, stages adorned with the props of wilderness, where the guest and participant could assume a role in the frontier past of Jim Bridger, General Custer, Sitting Bull, and Lewis and Clark. They had atmosphere." Sounds a lot like Westworld. This created atmosphere included the Blackfeet Indians, who were offered menial wages to set up teepees near park lodges and greet train passengers as publicity stunts for a massive advertising campaign.
"There's an Indian encampment nearby. We're on the edge of the great Blackfeet Reservation. And it's like turning back the pages of history to watch them sing and dance. The Blackfeet were once the terror of the North, but the tide of civilization has swept over them."
Another synthetic prop in the supposedly natural setting. Blackfeet tribal members, who had basically been turned into mascots for their own dispossession, were generally barred from entering these hotels, which is painfully ironic considering one of the most notable decorations in Mini Glacier, for example, was a huge 180-foot canvas mural painted by Blackfeet chiefs illustrating the tribe's history. Blackfeet, which came to be referred to as the Glacier Park Tribe for a while, were also extensively used on flyers and promotional materials for the park, the railroad, and its hotels. After spending the day singing and dancing for tourists, white employees would bring out kitchen scraps to feed the hungry native performers each night. Blackfeet elder and artist Daryl Norman described the spectacle as, "in some ways very humiliating, just to satisfy the curiosity of the traveler."
It's a horrifying story, but it is our history, but not necessarily our history. And this is why when I say, you know, during Black History Month, for example, so-called, you know, that people would be outraged if I said, well, why don't we have a white man's history month? And people will say, oh my gosh, that's so racist. And no, the point is to make the distinction and to sort of pierce the veil, as this does a little bit, and to say, you know, that something else is happening. Again, you can see that in Raoul Peck's HBO docuseries, Exterminate All the Brutes. And if this is true, then what you see happening, what you see unfolding over a 600-year period is not accidental or coincidental. And when you start to go back and understand the history of organizations like the East India Company that then seems to morph into a bank, HSBC, and these things just continue on right out in plain sight, and you start to take a different view of history and kind of who's who in the zoo. So again, the point being, the same thing is happening now. You know, if we're paying attention, what are we hearing? The same contingent whose generational progeny has stolen the natural resources of the earth. You know, I think we played the clip of Harari saying, if we didn't, I imagined it really, you know, I thought it really loud. Harari saying that back in the day, it was land, you know, and if you could grab as much land as possible, you were powerful, wealthy, and influential. Land was power. Now data is power, these guys say. And what does social media do? Maybe there's a reason that Jaron Lanier wrote a book titled 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media Accounts Right Now. He wrote a book. The father of virtual reality technology. Maybe there's a reason. Maybe there's a reason he's not on social media. Maybe he understands that this is the primary weapon or the primary tool used to arm a contingent that, you know, now it's going to be, you know, if you're listening to these folks, what are they saying? Resources are scarce, right? And, you know, we have to do everything we can to conserve resources and all of that. If you are this contingent that has it in your purview to maybe, you know, maybe eugenics, maybe we need to find a way to reduce that number, as Bill Gates said. It starts with the P at the beginning of that equation that he's talking about, innovating to zero. P is the first factor, and the P stands for people. One of these has to get pretty close to zero, he said. If you believe that, and if you believe that resources are scarce, hello? What do you think that means? Especially if you're engineering a scarcity, just like we heard with the mass extermination of the American buffalo, because Colonel Dodge had said every buffalo dead is an Indian gone, and buffalo extermination was the unwritten policy in the winning of the West. What's happening now? Have you seen the grocery store lately? What's happening? Meanwhile, we're being balkanized to weaponize us against ourselves and one another, and, you know, to distract us. Is Disney doing a special teaching kids about reparations for this? Or is it just more shameless, gratuitous exploitation? We, you know, again, it's, you know, it's Black History Month, so-called. Why do you suppose we hear so little about Native American Heritage Month? Most people, I mean, just to give you an idea, by comparison, Google search, do your own search and see what happens. Google search for Black History Month gives you 3.93 billion results, almost 4 billion results, versus 71.1 million results for Native American Heritage Month. 3.93, almost 4 billion search results versus less than 100 million. That's something. You know, 3.93 billion, we could say maybe that represents half the world's population or more. Just to, you know, contextualize that a little bit. Versus 71 million, which is a fraction, maybe, what, a quarter or less of the American population? Think about that. The narrative of, you know, the narrative of the latter is balkanizing, clearly pits us against one another. The former versus the latter. The latter being, you know, the Native American Heritage Month story. If you're hearing it the way that it is contextualized in the Overlooked, Lost in the Shining Hotel, episode one, or really the series so far, episodes one and two, it is not balkanizing. It brings the issue of eliminationism and all of us in the crosshairs of it into sharp, laser sharp focus. Stick around, we'll be right back.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
February is Heart Month. Every year for the month of February, to show our appreciation to ExtendoVite's faithful customers, we have a sale. If you would like to try Extendivite, now is the time to get a few months ahead and really give Extendivite the time to show you how it works. Most of Extendivite's long-term customers wait for this sale to stock up. People and doctors tell us about the unbelievable improvements that they have experienced in their overall health, not just the heart. Extendivite wants you to experience the power of these herbs. Get a four-month supply for only $115 for either the capsules or tincture. Please take advantage of this once-per-year sale and get healthy for life. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com or find us on Amazon.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Are you one of the millions of people who feel like there is a dark cloud hanging over their heads whenever they're using pharmaceutical drugs? For some, the short-term relief can turn into an opioid addiction nightmare. Have you ever wondered why CBD oil is a billion-dollar industry? It's because it works better than opioids and is actually healthy for you. However, CBD oil is stripped of all other helpful compounds found in the hemp plant. According to neuroscientists, the whole hemp plant, otherwise known as hemp paste, is even more effective than the chemically processed CBD oil. Are you ready to take back your health? You can try hemp paste by going to rbnhemppaste.com. That's rbnhemppaste.com.
Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we have been building our online store. Well, we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country. Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store. Your support of this network, plus products at the best prices, is a win-win situation. Check out our new store. Go to our website, republicbroadcasting.org, and click on the online store located at the top of our website. Together, we can continue to grow RBN and help our listeners prepare for the future. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on our online store, or call us
800-724-2719 extension 3. 800-724-2719 extension 3.
Welcome back. Though the subject matter on the surface seems different, this goes along with the Deus Ex Machina stuff from last week, the end of last week, and particularly Glenn Beck's Glenn TV episode 250, The AI Revolution is Here, How Machines Will Transform Your Entire World. What's the connection? Well, in simple terms, you know, we saw during COVID the Boston Dynamics dog or cheetah, whatever it is, patrolling parks, telling people to wear masks and stuff. Can we expect legions of those kinds of things, you know, Terminator robots basically, patrolling the streets of America? Not out of the question, I would say. We're going to barely have time to squeeze in the remainder of the clips, so we're going to get back to that. Aaron and Melissa Dykes, Overlooked, Lost in the Shining Hotel, Episode 1, The Environment. Next segment is Other Examples, Mount Hood and the National Park System. Go ahead, please.
It is not easy to realize the challenge that moving westward meant to these people. Even though they knew the danger, it was a complete uprooting of their lives.
Similar stories of using treaties that were ultimately broken to remove indigenous people can be found all across the nation, including in Oregon. The state where the pyramidal-shaped Timberline Lodge sits under Illumination Rock at the foot of Mount Hood. Oregon's highest point, settled within the Mount Hood National Forest. The mountain is named for Samuel Hood, 1st Viscount Hood, a British admiral at the Battle of the Chesapeake, and sits partly inside the reservation of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. These tribes signed a treaty back in 1855 that ceded 10 million acres of land to the government in exchange for a peace for their reservation and the rights to fish, hunt, gather berries and roots, and pasture livestock on the ceded lands. Just a decade later, a superintendent with Indian Affairs met with the tribes on the pretense that they were signing an agreement that tribal members would need to carry a written pass when leaving their reservation to use the ceded lands. What the Senate went on to ratify, however, was a supplemental treaty that claimed the tribe abused their use rights and therefore relinquished them to the government. When the tribes learned this was a supplemental treaty, they insisted the document they were presented with said nothing at all about relinquishing their rights. Despite never being officially enforced, the dispute over this deception and the use of this so-called supplemental treaty against these tribes apparently continues to this day.
But again and again, the pioneers had to be on a sharp lookout for attack. Their struggle for survival against the Indians was never-ending. They were a relentless enemy who resented the coming of the white settlers. They fought tooth and nail for every foot of ground, exacting a terrible toll. Just as hard as the Indians fought, so did the pioneers who needed the land for their families and for freedom.
The peak of Mount Hood and its upper slopes are located in a protected area inside the Mount Hood National Forest that was actually dedicated the Mount Hood Wilderness Area in 1964. The supposed pristine Eden of these national parks was further codified for the, quote, permanent good of the whole people in the Wilderness Act of 1964, which placed a legally binding protective overlay on 9 million acres of national parks, forests, and other government lands. The act portrays these lands as though they were always an unpeopled landscape, the most telling language defining wilderness as hereby recognized as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. And further, an area of undeveloped land retaining its primeval character and influence without permanent improvements or human habitation. Not only does this act completely separate humans from nature, but gives the impression of a pure natural landscape devoid of humans in complete contradiction to thousands of years of known history. As Isaac Cantor wrote in Public Land and Resources Law Review, national parks do not preserve what the West was, they preserve a West which never was. The entire national park system has been presented to Americans as a patriotic conservation project for a virgin wilderness, a showcase of nature in its primeval, untouched state. But this is a complete illusion. Cantor continues, these landscapes were inhabited, their features named, their forests utilized, their plants harvested, and animals hunted. Native Americans have a history in our national parks measured in millennia. They were forcibly removed, and later treaty rights to traditional use, such as hunting and fishing, were erased, often without acknowledgement or compensation. Immediately after these removals, the parks were advertised as a showcase of uninhabited America, nature's handiwork unspoiled. Keep America clean, am I right? It's uncanny to be in a place once inhabited by people for thousands of years, only for them to be purged, and then for everyone else to pretend like they were never there in the first place. Uncanny how you can't shake the feeling of being watched the whole time you're playing on the playground.
While the pioneers fought for their lives and their hard-won land, speculators living in splendor in the eastern cities had their eyes on these rich new areas, and by political and financial power were able to seize or acquire legal rights to land they had never seen. They could destroy the hard work of the pioneer who had no recourse but to accept the decree of their own government.
And today, the U.S. government owns the majority of Oregon. In fact, the government owns 47% of all land in the West. The civilizing of the Wild West can be typified in this iconic 1872 painting by John Gast, titled American Progress. It depicts the goddess Columbia, adorned with the Star of Empire on her forehead, carrying the line of the telegraph and leading settlers westward by trains and in covered wagons, driving the Indians at Buffalo out of the picture. As manifest destiny, a concept embodying the 19th century American drive to remake the Wild West in the image of the American East, takes hold. Back in 1963, historian Frederick Merck wrote that manifest destiny was born out of a sense of mission to redeem the old world by high example, generated by the potentialities of a new earth for building a new heaven. How many people ever notice the goddess is carrying a schoolbook under her right arm? Quite a fancy way of dressing up imperialism. An imperialism that never stopped once America's borders were officially mapped. And yet, even still, the early beginnings of this now centuries-old history hardly ever gets seen for what it really was. What it really is. As a narrow slice of a very one-sided history continues to get plastered over the truth. As historian and author Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz puts it, the myth persists not for a lack of free speech or poverty of information, but rather for an absence of motivation to ask questions that challenge the core of the scripted narrative of the origin story. How might acknowledging the reality of U.S. history work to transform society?
So, again, we don't have a whole lot of time to pause here, but are you aware of the amount of federal ownership of land? Alaska, 60%. California, 45% federal ownership. Idaho, 62%, plus or minus. Montana, 29%. Memory serves, Wyoming is up there quite a ways. I don't want to get fixated on this, but you know, hundreds of millions of acres. And what did we see as Obama was leaving office? What was it? 500 million acres went into federal. More acres went into federal conservancy. There's more, but for now, continuing with this history lesson. Go ahead, please.
With heartbreak, but yet with stout hearts, the American pioneer overcame even the barriers erected by men and won and settled new lands and made new homes.
Westward. There are all kinds of these removals. They could all be termed as trails of tears. I think the trail of tears, I know it's an enigmatic sort of statement and title. I don't like it. It kind of avoids the harshness of that situation, doesn't it? It makes it kind of seem like poetry. It's not poetry. It's, you are literally removing these people from their lands forever and taking away all they know and literally impoverishing them and placing them on a reservation where they have nothing and they are completely under the control of the U.S. government.
This is the heritage which is America, a heritage drawn from many peoples, all of whom had one purpose, to build for themselves and their children a land of freedom from oppression and prejudice.
Well, sometimes I can see things that happened a long time ago. I think a lot of things happened right here in this particular hotel over the years. And not all of them was good.
So the dual history of the American West, and not all of it was good. Next segment, Calumet, double acting. This was always a double game, a devil's bargain. Go ahead, please.
Broken treaties, buried history calling out silently just under the surface. And like Stephen King wrote and Kubrick flaunts in our faces on screen in The Shining, the Indian is everywhere in these parks, and hardly anyone sees or acknowledges them. Perhaps that's why Kubrick chose to put up so many Calumet cans on the Overlook's pantry shelf.
Calumet is a noun, French, out of Latin, defined as a kind of pipe used by the North American Indians as a symbol of peace. To accept a calumet is to agree to the terms of peace, and to refuse it is to reject them. The calumet of peace is used to seal and ratify contracts or alliances. Calumet baking powder, however, is double acting. This was always a double game. A devil's bargain.
So, what has happened to industry? What did we hear at the beginning of COVID? Food shortages, you know, MIT telling us we're never going back to normal. What has been happening over in the Netherlands, the Dutch farmers' protest for the last few years, actually? What has happened to the mining and timber industry, the natural resources industry that have been offshored, or the automotive industry, you know, things that have been pieced out to other nations? Remember, speaking of a longer view of history, remember H.G. Wells' book, The New World Order, that was published back in 1939, and how Wells wrote in it that toil is no longer economically viable, so to speak. He wrote, in the technically crude past, the illiterate have-nots were sweated and overworked. It was easy to find toil to keep them all busy. Such surplus multitudes are wanted no more. Toil is no longer marketable. Machines can toil better and with less resistance. This was, you know, the intellectual firebrand, you might say, of the Fabian contingent. So, next excerpt, we could barely get most of it in, I think. Go ahead, please.
But this damaging cycle, this deadly recursive loop, isn't just repeated on decimated native populations destroyed and forgotten. This was just the beginning, a foundation. It's a repeating pattern so thoroughly woven into our society, we hardly notice it anymore. In the power structure, in the workplace, in the family, in cycles of abuse handed down and perpetuated generation after generation, and within the individual who suppresses his or her own identity in order to kiss ass and climb the social ladder in a desperate act to belong, until people don't even know themselves anymore, if they ever did in the first place. This is a society that has so much food in the pantry it could eat a different menu every day for a year, and yet it eats its own. A uniquely American story.
And this is the environment.
This is the environment.
Where we are taught not to face the uncomfortable past, to accept it.
To accept and not react to violence.
To make excuses and try to justify it. To ignore it.
Or to ignore it altogether. Pretend it never happened.
Pretend it never happened and dutifully go about our day. The social norms are set within a certain parameter.
A certain boundary. And if you want to get anywhere in this society,
you better stay within the lines.
You better see only what you're taught to see.
And keep your eyes wide shut.
And keep your eyes wide shut to everything else.
To silence that little voice inside.
Picking up on all the warning signs and practically screaming.
And practically screaming at us that something ain't right here.
It's okay. I saw it on the television.
Our brains receive and process sense information from our environment in order to build a model of that environment. A map we base our decisions and resultant behaviors on in order to continue living and surviving in this place. But the map is not the territory. What happens when things keep getting moved ever so slightly out of the corner of our eyes and behind our backs so that we can never fully grasp where we truly are? And that's the maze we're all trapped in. The maze that exists, but doesn't exist, in the Overlook Hotel.
So that's it. I mean, you heard it. This damaging cycle, deadly recursive loop. What we heard, as you heard, was just the beginning, a foundation. Really, not even a beginning, but part of the ongoing saga. It's a pattern. As you heard, it's a repeating pattern, so thoroughly woven into our society, we hardly notice it anymore. And that's what these guys are referring to when they say, for example, the interwebs will fade into the walls and we won't even notice them. It'll be like this. And again, cycles of abuse handed down and perpetuated generation after generation. That is what the cultural Marxist contingent is all about. Pouring that in stone, you know, etching that in stone or pouring that in concrete. And as we heard, within the individual who suppresses his or her own identity in order to, you know, climb the social ladder in a desperate act to belong, until people don't even know themselves anymore, the actual individual is unrecognizable. Because again, in communitarian vernacular, there is no identity apart from the group, and it's beyond that now, because we played clips of Harari, I think yesterday, and the end of last week, I think Friday, saying that according to the Davos set, you know, this is the guy who says that rights and, you know, all of this, these are just myths that people made up. Well, this guy's telling a story. He's telling, you know, the storyteller is telling a story saying that these things were all stories. You have no rights. He just, in one bold swipe of history, he basically attempts to cancel out all of the American Revolutionary past. And that is in keeping precisely with what we just heard. Perpetual cycles of abuse. Where is the cultural Marxist victim psychopathy headed? The slow rolling attempt that you've seen over the past few years, since about 2017, 2018 in particular, that overlaps with the Me Too stuff. The slow rolling attempt to normalize the MAP, so-called pedophiles, is what they really are. The minor attracted person. You know, maybe this guy wants to marry a 5-year-old, and now there's child propaganda. Have you seen that? Books written for children that adults can fight over to attempt to normalize the homosexual minor attracted person. Well, you know, it's just a polar bear and a seal. So, you know, maybe it's, you know, it's just a story, Chris. Come on. They're pedophiles. So the slow-rolling attempt, the onslaught of attempting to normalize this kind of thing occurring in recent years, that is the syncretistic way of the dialectical conflict of, you know, the duality of opposites. We're going to merge them. So now, what do you see happening? Me Too that whole Me Too, you know, soundbite propaganda campaign has been assimilated. Saturation level reached. And because of all of this other, you know, lack of boundaries, generally speaking, now this other thing is attempting to be normalized. What do you suppose happens when you have a generation of folks who have been victimized in this sort of way? There are some really interesting articles on this. And by interesting, I mean horrifying. One article that I've seen recently, there's an article back in 2021 in New Yorker magazine titled "The German Experiment That Placed Foster Children with Pedophiles." And, you know, this is not unlike, you know, the Kinsey experiments, for example, and things that we've seen. This is, in other words, this was not an anomaly. You know, this is more of a pattern, obviously. So what happens when you do that to, say, a generation of people? This perpetual cycle of abuse that's been inflicted upon people that now cannot, you know, the gentleman, one gentleman who's interviewed in the article that I mentioned said that he tried to get a job as a postal worker, I think, and the article says, once he tried to work as a mailman, but after a few days, you know, after being placed in a foster home with a homosexual pedophile, once he tried to work as a mailman, but after a few days he quit because whenever a stranger made an expression that reminded him of his foster father, an engineer named Fritz Henkel, he had the sensation that he was not actually alive, that his heart had stopped beating, and that the color had drained from the world. When he tried to speak, it felt as if his voice didn't belong to him. What happens when you have an entire generation of folks who feel that way? I would encourage you to watch the first two episodes. They're long, obviously, but these days everything is long-form content. The Overlooked, Lost in the Shining Hotel, Episode 1, The Environment, hour and 42 minutes. Episode 2 is out, premiered over the weekend, the 11th, and it's titled Overlooked, Lost in the Shining Hotel, Episode 2, The Management. I hope it was informative. As always, it truly is an honor and a pleasure. Take care. God bless. We'll catch you on the other side.
My name is John. I'm the founder of Blackout Coffee, and I started Blackout because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee. It's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
Visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.